Welcome back for the third hour of Issues Etc. We're continuing Open Lines. I'm Todd Wilkin, talking about what's going on in Indiana among the Southern Baptist Convention. They're meeting there, 8,000 of them in representation of 16.3 million Christians in the United States. 505-7850-1800-730-2727. Several questions have emerged from this conversation with our listeners here. One of them has to do with whether or not, now the Southern Baptist got a resolution that kind of surfaced for a second and then went back underwater, but it made headlines in today's St. Louis Post-Dispatch and also caught the attention of Cal Thomas, nationally syndicated columnist, calling for Southern Baptists to pull their kids out of public schools because it's beyond repair. Pull your kids out, homeschool them, send them to parochial schools. Do you think it's a good idea or a bad idea? 505-7850-1800-730-2727. Before we go on and take your phone calls, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, about once a year we have one of these commentaries here. This is, I'll be quite honest with you, not the kind of stuff you read in your lighthearted moments on the beach. This is a reference book. And there's nothing wrong with having good, solid reference books on your shelf. You think, well, I pretty much got Romans down, and I think Galatians makes a lot of sense to me. The Gospels are not brain surgery. But there are books that are very difficult to understand without expertise help, almost impossible sometimes to sort out right from wrong. The book of Leviticus is one of those. That's why we offer these commentaries in the Concordia Commentary series. The book is called the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus. You can browse before you buy by going to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. You can also purchase the book by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Now, if you're not interested personally, but you're looking for, say, Father's Day gift for your husband, or if you're looking for it may be a gift for your pastor, a former parish pastor. I can tell you, folks, someone would have handed this one to me. I would have been very grateful. I get them now gratis as a radio talk show host. Have no one to thank except the publishing house. Your pastor would thank you to receive the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus, the Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for June. 1-800-325-3040. During the break, that long break there at the top of the hour, we had a caller call in. She was concerned that I might have sounded a bit arrogant in the previous segment of Open Line. Some people now are kind of shaking their heads and chuckling, saying, Wilkin sounds arrogant every day of the week. So what? I gotta be me. I gotta be me. Well, when I said that it's a sad day when we have to depend on the Southern Baptists to say these kind of things in the public square and in the church. And I speak that as a Lutheran. Okay, Lutheranism has been around for 500 years. Southern Baptists are newcomers, historically speaking, to the Protestant world. Now, what does it say when they're 16.3 million strong? What does it say when they have fought battles for the Bible and decided, for the most part, to go the right direction? So they've been around for, what, 100 years as a denomination? As opposed to, and again, I speak as a Lutheran. Someone called in earlier kind of mockingly talking about turning back the clock 500 years. When the relative newcomer to the block is the voice of wisdom in the church? It is a sad day, isn't it? When the grandchild has to correct the grandfather. That's how I meant the... I wasn't trying to demean Baptists or Calvinists or anyone else. I was saying, look, when your kids actually have to be the voice of reason in the home, the parents aren't doing their job. Now, the parents in the Reformation are the Lutherans, just by virtue of the longer history. The children in the house, relatively speaking, are the Baptists. And yet they're the ones who are speaking with the voice of reason in the church and outside the church. 505-7850-1800-730-2727. Mike is on the line, and he's calling from his car. Mike, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Pastor Todd. Thanks for taking my call. I wasn't going to say this, but since you just got to mentioning, I do listen to 91.5 once in a while, the Baptist radio station, and they do have a lot of good programs on concerning social issues of today. And with your show, that's on KFUO, I find those very interesting, and I wish more Lutherans did speak out. But with that said, I find it, on another note, I find it troubling that you have said what you said today about pulling our children out of Christian schools and or public schools and putting them in Christian schools, and why there is an issue with that. It seems like you're making the point that there may be some trouble ahead if we would do that for the public schools. And as far as I'm concerned, it couldn't be a day too soon that the public schools would shrink and more children would be in a Christian school. And I have to point to the words of Martin Luther, and I realize he does not speak with the divine nature such as the Bible does, but the man was one of the had more wisdom than anyone in a long time. And when he speaks to say that you should put your children in a Christian education and do everything possible to do that, I couldn't agree more. I mean, we look at what the public schools are teaching. Why would we want to force ourselves just to stay at our post, as you would say, at the public schools when they're being taught the wrong things? What is more important? I realize what you're saying, and I understand the point you're trying to make, but at the cost of having them learn day by day things that are incorrect, I can't see the justification in that.
Well, okay. First of all, just stay here for a second, Mike.
I am.
First of all, not every public school, and especially if you talk about public schools throughout the Midwest, the heartland of America, not every public school is as egregiously in such an egregious situation as every other public school. You would agree there?
I would certainly agree, and I could point out that there are some good public schools, especially here in the St. Louis area, that don't have the same curriculum as other schools, especially as you would find on the East and West Coast.
Right, and the reason for my caution is twofold. One, on a case-by-case basis, the Christian has to decide, rather than just saying public school bad, kid comes out, say the public school in my particular community where I live, I think the majority of the, someone has told me on several occasions that the majority of the school teachers in the elementary level are Christians, bona fide church-going Christians, and that in that school, not in the district, but in the particular elementary school, it is not unusual for the teachers to say, now look here, kiddos, the school book says that this rock is a million years old. That may not necessarily be true. I mean, they're actually offering some corrective in the classroom to some of the teachings that are found in the textbook. So on a case-by-case basis, the second basis for my my caution is this, and this is a very thoroughly Lutheran concept, and I thank you very much for the call. We are not only concerned about our kids, as we ought to be, rightly concerned about our kids first and foremost as parents. We're also concerned about our neighbor. So if all Christians withdraw their kids out of the public schools, what is left for our neighbor in the public school? And even our unbelieving neighbor in the public school? Will we leave them without any witness? Or, will we, just in terms of education, will we leave them with something that's falling apart? I know you can say, that's where we say, come to our school. Now, not everyone can afford to come to your school. There are some people who, by force, by necessity of their situation, will be sending their kids to public school, whether they like it or not, right? And if Christians withdraw in mass, what are we leaving there for our neighbor? I understand the sentiment says they couldn't go to hell in a handbasket fast enough. I'd like to see it just fall apart. I understand that sentiment. But I think we do have to be mindful of our unbelieving neighbor who still is going to send their kid to public school. Mike is calling from his car. Mike, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks for taking my call. I was just calling, too, about the public school thing. It's not so much curriculum that I'm concerned with. I do homeschool my children. I've got seven. And it's the environment. I took my son recently to our local high school, which is very highly rated and one of the schools that you would probably put in the categories of one of the good ones. And as I waited for him, he had to take his ACT test at the local high school. And while we waited, we saw three or four teenage couples doing things that were probably inappropriate, at least in my eyes. Most of the girls that were there were immodestly dressed. There was a couple of guys came in using foul language, and I had to actually take my son down the hall until the test actually started to get him away from that. So I don't really think, I mean, even the curriculum's good, it's the environment that they're in. And I would take issue with your idea that our children have to be sacrificed to save the public schools. I mean, that's just, you know, if it's us in there, you know.
Now, Mike, you know that that's not the point I'm making. You know
that. Well, but that's exactly what happens, though. If you send your kids to public schools and your justification is that you're trying to prop it up and keep it from falling down and falling down around all the other children who are in there, then yes, I believe that's exactly what's being said. And I don't think that's our job. Yes,
so every man, so it's really, you really, are you advocating, I mean, since you have characterized my comments in that way, so I would feel free to then ask you,
yes,
are you saying it's every man for himself?
Not necessarily, but I'm saying I'm not willing to sacrifice my children for the sake of my neighbor children. Now, do I have a responsibility and do my children have a responsibility to be salt and light? Yeah, absolutely. But to put them in an environment where I believe their spirituality is compromised because of the environment they're in, I don't believe that's justified,
right.
Especially because they're children. I mean, adults and adult believers are able to handle things far better than Christian children and young people, and I think that it's just, you know how it is. Well, I don't know about where at KFUO there, but I know in the world I work in, where there's a majority of unbelievers, it's a struggle sometimes, and I don't necessarily want to put my children in that environment when there are alternatives, and the alternatives are Christian school, and sometimes even you have to be careful there, but our homeschooling, and I just don't see the justification for trying to salvage that system, which, by the way, I would also change the terminology there. They're not public schools. They're government schools. They are run by the federal government.
Yeah, but is that necessarily a bad thing, government school?
Well, not necessarily, but it does tend to flavor the way that things are done. There's a lot of bureaucracy. Even some of the local systems will tell you, you know, that they're bogged down with a lot of the federal issues that are involved in that. So I just, you know, you're right. It doesn't necessarily make it a bad thing, but it can tend to, because government tends to mess up a lot of things that it gets itself involved in, obviously.
Yeah, well, but the same, Mike, the same thing can be said for the church. I mean, the church, one of my favorite guests here on this program, Pastor Bill Swirla, I will always remember him saying this. He says, the church has survived 2,000 years of what can only be called gross mismanagement, and it's still here. The church is the most mismanaged institution on earth. Far worse than government, folks. You think government's bad? Sometimes, look, I work for a church. You find more virtue in a state bureaucracy office sometimes than you will in the church organization as an organization. More honest accounting, more honest employees. I'm not joking with you, folks. You can't get away from sinners. Now, I will say this. Look, and I commend Mike for homeschooling 7 children. I do take issue with him characterizing my comments as sacrificing our children for the sake of the neighbor kids. You are called to sacrifice yourself, by the way. Not your kids, but yourself. And there's no way of getting around that. When I make the point that if Christians withdraw in mass, what are we leaving for our neighbor? I'm saying there's a basic concern about human care, therefore our neighbor, whoever he may be, that we cannot ignore. That if we know in advance that pulling out of a situation will leave our neighbor in dire need, then we stay. Now, that may or may not apply to the public schools, but I do raise the concern. I think it's a legitimate concern. Christians are never called to follow the credo, every man for himself. Never. Never. By the way, as the product of parochial schools, from preschool to postgraduate school, and in particular, Lutheran high school, I can tell you folks, and this is Lutherans aren't just that bad. Everything you can find in the public school going on, you can find in parochial high schools. Everything. You know what is sometimes the greater shame? What you find in parochial high schools sometimes is glossed over because we're Christians. sometimes incompetence is glossed over, sometimes in dishonesty. Oh, come on, we're a church organization, winkety wink. Things that would never be tolerated if it were being run by the government or any other private enterprise. We sometimes tolerate and encourage because, come on, we're all Christians here. Harold is calling from St. Charles. Harold, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, I'm so glad there that you had Dr. Paige Patterson on today. And in the past there, Dr. R. Albert Mueller, who's a real gem every time that you have him on. And I remember once you had one of his faculty members on, and you made the comment after he made his presentation, where were you in my seminary days? I understand that as a solid faculty. My professor brother was invited to be a pallbearer for a very good friend of Dr. Anderson, who was on the faculty down there, and got to meet Dr. R. Albert Mueller, and was so impressed with him that when he got back, he tried to urge the fellow faculty members here at the seminary to invite him up for some lectures. You know, two or three times a year they have people come in and lecture to the students. Pardon me a moment. And they turned him down. I said, well, you know, he's some Baptist guy or something like that. And that really put me off, but please continue to have him there.
Happy to do it, Harold, and thank you for the call. You know, we had a caller earlier kind of, I think, mockingly talk about, ecumenical efforts at their best. This is what true ecumenicity is. This is what true ecumenical efforts are. It is where Christians honestly disagree, and yet where they can agree, they engage in fraternal discussion. You know, maybe we're not going to ever agree, but if we can be enlightened by the likes of Paige Patterson or Albert Mueller, I agree. I mean, every time you open the box with him, it's like the engagement ring is twinkling in your eyes. It's unbelievable. It's a shame that we don't listen to them. Who knows, one day we might find that they have the gospel and we don't, because we've been so busy saying we are Lutherans and we've got all our stuff stashed away in a lockbox someplace. Popular efforts in ecumenism are really not ecumenism at all. Come on, let's agree to disagree, or let's not define our terms. You know, we could not have an intelligent conversation with Albert Mueller if we didn't define our terms with him. I can have him on to talk about the state of the church, but we're not going to sit down and commune together. Whereas in popular ecumenicity, they don't have a conversation about theology, and they sit down and commune together. How crazy is that? Let's have communion. I mean, forget about theology, forget about the Bible, let's have communion. No, true ecumenism is, before we sit down together, let's have a little conversation about the Bible. And as long as we disagree, let's respect one another and love one another and love the church enough to continue to disagree. Not to agree to disagree, but to continue to disagree honestly. Maybe one day we will agree. Someone's going to have to change. So Dr. Albert Mueller would be the best Reformed Baptist he can possibly be, and I'll be the best Lutheran I can possibly be, and maybe never the twain shall meet. But where the lines do cross, we will happily stand arm in arm. And where they don't cross, we won't. And we can still regard one another as fellow Christians. That is true ecumenicity. That is a true ecumenical effort. It's certainly not ecumenical to simply write off both Lutherans and Baptists as desiring to turn the clock back on the church. But I would say this, I was thinking about this during the break. I wouldn't turn back the clock 500 years. I'd turn it back 2,000. Sandy's calling from Alton, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Sandy, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just wanted to touch on what one of your former callers had said regarding public schools, and he redefined it as government schools, and I've got to be in wholehearted agreement with that. The NEA is just totally invested in many agendas that are anti-family and, of course, anti-Christian.
But, Sandy, hold on a second.
Yes.
I'm not going to let Mike get away with it. I'm not going to let you get away with it.
I'm not agreeing with his comment about his how he regarded your statement.
No, but what I'm saying is, no, but this whole idea of it's a government school and that automatically means it's a bad thing.
Pretty much.
Would
yeah.
you say the same thing about the U.S. military? It's a government institution.
It has its problems. It has its problems, and it needs accountability through the public. And I think, you know...
Would you say that about the U.S. Constitution? It's a government document.
It's a government document, and it is beholden to the precepts that have been established. Yeah, they can't be redefined.
Do you believe in good government, Sandy?
Absolutely, I believe in good government. As good as humanly possible.
Right. Sandy, what my point with you, and I thank you for putting up with my questions.
There. That's okay.
My point here is, Christians dare... If only on the basis of Romans 12 and 13, Christians dare not allow government to become a code word for something like atheistic, evil, satanic, blah, blah. Especially when we've got the kind of government we've got, Sandy. We have got good,
Absolutely.
Good government.
Absolutely. But it has gone awry. Let me, do I have a moment just to finish my comment?
I can give you no more than 30 seconds because we're up on a break.
Just a comment that you had mentioned, the devil is the author of novelty. Well, about 45 years ago, 50 years ago, we had Lucey throwing out phonics. We now call it whole language, new math. Cultural diversity, redefining family, and history revisionism. I think he's been very busy in government school.
Oh, thank you, Sandy. Sure. Although I don't think the devil really cares about phonics. You know, I don't. That might be stretching it a bit. Vivian, our time is very short. Thank you for calling.
Okay. I love your show. I listen regularly, but I have to really disagree and think you're a bit naive, Todd, to say that, no, we can't have every man for himself. That's not what it is. It's God's people separating themselves. And there is no admission charge to get into churches. People don't want to come to the churches. They don't want Christianity. They know how their kids are dressed when they leave the house. They like it that way. They know their children are dating. They encourage their children to date. So for you to leave your children in a public school in that environment and think that you are light, that is just crazy.
All right, Vivian, thank you. I don't know how that is something other than every man for himself. Not, you know, you try not to bind consciences, and there you go. I mean, even the Baptists aren't going to bind consciences when it comes to leaving the public schools. I will tell you this, folks. You can keep your kid out of the public school. You can forbid all belly shirts. Earrings, piercings, tattoos of all sorts. You can forbid everything that you'll find that you don't like about the public schools. And you can keep your children insulated from that. And golly, you won't find a better advocate for that than me. You still have not solved the problem. You are still going to have a little sinner on your hands. You can wash the outside of the cup all you want. When the inside is still filthy, the only real answer, whether you're sending your kid to public school or private school, or parochial school, or homeschooling, then the only real answer to the real problem that does not reside in the public school or in the government, but in you and in your kids, that is your sin, the only real answer is a steady diet of Jesus Christ. Now, if you're not giving your kids that at home, keeping them out of the public school isn't going to keep them out of hell, I can guarantee you. We'll be right back to talk with Bill Salmon.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. However, we are not funded by the church body. We're also not affiliated with Lutheran Hour Ministries or the Lutheran Layman's League. Issues, Etc. is supported by listeners like you. Please help support this worldwide outreach by making a gift this week. Our address, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Thanks for your prayerful consideration.
Wouldn't it be great if we went through life without any problems? Well, that's just not the way things are. Life can get tough, but we can face whatever comes along with peace and confidence because there is reason for hope. We're your neighbors, the people of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we'd like you to know that with Christ, there's plenty of hope to go around.
A message from your friends at Issues, Etc.
Ancient aviators, those terrific pterosaurs.
Answers with Ken Ham author of the thrilling book on dinosaurs for young people called The Dinosaurs of Eden. Well, Ken, I've often heard secular scientists say that most of those flying reptiles, like the pterosaurs, would have been terrible flyers. But is there any evidence to support that?
Actually, new evidence shows that pterosaurs were not primitive, clumsy flyers at all. In fact, they might have outperformed today's birds in doing some complex aerobatic maneuvers. Their balance seems to have been quite remarkable. X-ray scans of pterosaur skulls have revealed that a large region of their brain integrated signals from joints, muscles, skin, and balance organs. In birds, this region is unusually large compared to other animals, about 1-2% of the bird's total brain mass. But in the pterosaurs, this region took up an incredible 7.5%, probably because of their large wings. As a result, it appears they had excellent flight control. The question that has to be asked is, how could such a flight-controlling brain have evolved? The answer's simple. It couldn't have. Here's what else I know. Pterosaurs and birds were created on day 5 just a few thousand years ago along with other flying creatures, and they are perfectly formed to be able to fly.
Ken Ham has written a fascinating booklet on dinosaurs and how the Bible, not evolution, has the best explanation of their many mysteries. His booklet is available free on our attractive website, AnswersRadio.com. AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Proper nutrition is important for everyone, especially for young, growing bodies. But our children won't learn about nutrition from TV commercials. About a quarter of all commercials advertise food. Much of the food that is advertised is high in fat, salt, and sugar. High-sugar cereals are especially advertised on children's TV shows. TV commercials can lead our children to have seriously mistaken ideas about nutrition. Jesus loves our children very much. He died on the cross for them. Explain to your children that since Jesus loves them, He wants them to have strong, healthy bodies. And one of the best ways to do that is to avoid many of the foods they see advertised on TV. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Issues, Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights, Illinois. Bethany Lutheran is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. The Reverend Randy Emmons is the pastor. Their phone number, 618-632-6906. 632-6906. Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights. www.bethanylcms.org. Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., is gay marriage neutral? Jennifer Roback Morse of the Hoover Institute will be our guest to talk about that. Also, we'll discuss the Gnostic Gospels with Dr. Ben Witherington of Asbury Theological Seminary. And during Open Lines tomorrow, I would like your answer to this question. Perhaps you've seen the news, and I'd like you to think about this overnight. Join us tomorrow for Open Lines and answer this question. Rush Limbaugh is on his big Rush Limbaugh fan, so please bear that in mind here. He is on his third wife. He's now going to be on his third divorce. It's been announced, it's official, that... and by the way, I send my kids to parochial school, too. I wouldn't send them public school for all the money in the world. And it ain't cheap. He's on his third divorce. Now, this obviously comes upon the heels of a drug addiction and admission, some time in rehab. He's under legal assault down there in Florida. All of that laying aside, it's a man who's been thrice divorced. Now, has he lost his moral credibility to speak on that issue? On moral issues? That's the question for tomorrow. Another Rush Limbaugh Open Lines. These usually garner a lot of response for our listeners. Third divorce? Moral credibility gone? Think about it overnight. Bill Salmon is our guest in the last 25 minutes of the program. We're going to talk about the Bush presidency. He's senior White House correspondent for the Washington Times, and he's author of a new book titled Misunderestimated, The President Battles Terrorism, John Kerry and the Bush Haters. Bill, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bill, President Bush himself refers to himself as the master of low expectations. What does Bush mean by that?
Well, I think it goes back to the title of, you know, Misunderestimated. People, you know, when he coined that word the day before the 2000 election, which, of course, made him president, I think people laughed and said, well, there goes Bush again with another malapropism, which reinforced the image of him as someone who was sort of an intellectual lightweight. And I think instead it ends up capturing his political track record, which is people misunderstand his appeal to the American voter, and they also underestimate his considerable political skills. So when he talks about being the master of low expectations, I think he actually plays to that. He enjoys that, because when people count him out as some sort of dummy, he ends up performing above expectations, and people are therefore pleased.
One of the, and this is rather recent here, Bill, one of the recent appeals to that image of the president as not very smart, but kind of in the hands of political handlers who have a nefarious goal in mind, is Michael Moore's new film, Fahrenheit 9/11. It, as far as I can tell from the previews of the thing that are now playing on television, intimates or explicitly accuses the president of either masterminding or willingly permitting the 9/11 terrorist attacks so that he could launch a war that he thought was overdue with Iraq. What's your response to this?
Well, you know, there's always going to be sort of the black helicopter crowd that goes in for crazy conspiracies. I think it's profane, to be honest with you, to suggest that any president of the United States, I don't care if it's a Republican or a Democrat, to suggest that they somehow had advance knowledge of the most monstrous act of mass murder in our country's history, in which 3,000 innocent men, women, and children were killed, civilians, and didn't raise a finger to stop that. It is just beyond description. I mean, I just think it's vulgar, it's profane, it's not worthy of serious political discussion.
Both President Bush's appeal, you mentioned before, and the vehement reaction he gets from his critics. You start out your book talking about, and this is a harrowing account you have of Bush trying to make it through Portland.
Right.
I think it's Portland, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
To the Hilton Hotel, and then what happens afterwards with the protesters there. This kind of appeal and this kind of vehement reaction is not easily explained by Bush's character alone. What is at work in these two divergent reactions to this president?
Well, you're absolutely right, because, you know, you think of Bush's character, he seems like an affable fella. I mean, he seems like you may disagree with his policies, but he seems like a fairly reasonable human being. So there is this disconnect between that image of him and then this virulent hatred that you see on the left. I asked Bush about this because he was very gracious in terms of giving me interviews for this book, and I also talked to his top advisors. I think the best answer I got came actually from Condoleezza Rice's national security advisor. She said, look, when Bush got into office by such a narrow margin in 2000, his detractors figured that he wouldn't try to do too much. He would be basically afraid of his own shadow because of the closeness of the election. But instead he came in and said, look, to his team of advisors, we are going to govern as if we have a mandate to govern. We're going to do big things. Instead of doing, for example, an itty-bitty tax cut, as he might call it, they pushed through a big tax cut, and then a second, and then a third. And then after 9/11, you saw George W. Bush's leadership grow even bolder, where he was waging and winning wars. He was profoundly changing U.S. foreign policy to one of preemption. He was really almost remaking the geopolitical landscape, if you will. And the detractors said, wait a minute, this guy was supposed to be afraid of a shadow. He's now implementing, he's succeeding, he's implementing large chunks of his agenda. Major initiatives are now becoming law, are becoming, you know, the sort of the lay of the land here. And so I think their resentment at him getting into office boiled up into this irrational hatred that we've seen so much. I don't think it's a useful political emotion, but nonetheless there is.
He is also, both as governor in Texas, I'm a native Texan, and as president subsequently, shown an ability to, kind of the ability that Clinton had when he was in office, to cherry pick his opponent's agenda and to take credit for doing things that his opponents would like to have done.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, for example, Medicare reform was supposed to be a big hot issue. What did Bush do? He had the Republicans push through a version of Medicare reform. Education reform was something that, you know, a generation ago Republicans were talking about abolishing the Department of Education. Bush, realizing the realities of today's politics, said, no, we're going to actually expand the federal role in education, took that issue off the table. And in a larger sense, I think because of his policies, he has managed to take even larger issues off the table, like the economy. I mean, the economy is booming, and it's becoming increasingly difficult for Democrats to sort of demagogue the economy and talk it down when everywhere around you see it is flourishing. The war in Iraq, it's been very difficult, especially the post-war period, but now you have this handover that's going to happen in a matter of days to the Iraqis. And although our involvement over there will continue, I think you are starting to see sort of the beginning of the end of this very difficult chapter in American history, that is our involvement with Iraq. And I think for Bush, politically, it can only get better because he's had a pretty rough patch.
Well, I'm smack dab in the middle of the biography, part two biography of Theodore Roosevelt. The book's called Theodore Rex, talking about Roosevelt's presidential years. And right in the middle of the book is also right at the in the same place where Bush is now in his presidency, moving toward a second term, if possible, if he can be reelected. Now, you know, Teddy Roosevelt made it onto Mount Rushmore.
Sure.
President Bush has had to, in his short amount of time there in his first term, a very eventful first term. 9/11 is first and foremost among it. How are we to understand either the greatness or the lack of greatness of this president if it's going to be completely shaped by that one event, September 11th, 2001?
First of all, I think you have to say that this president has been thrust into contention for greatness by unwelcome circumstances, obviously. It'll be years, obviously, before we can determine whether he belongs to that select club of great presidents, and you and I will both be dead by the time people figure that out, historians. But I think in a way that Bill Clinton never was, Bush has been confronted with great challenges. That is, you know, 9/11, the war on terror, obviously, you know, the economy went into a recession. And so, you know, I cover the Clinton administration. There's rich irony here because Clinton used to ruminate, especially towards the end of his term, about how he probably wouldn't be considered among the great presidents because he had governed through a period of 8 years of peace and prosperity, and that usually you have to have a war or a depression or something to overcome as a president to be regarded as great, and he hadn't done that. And Bush came in, and he was going to kind of try to be a lower-profile president, not necessarily take on any big issues, and lo and behold, 9/11 hits, and he's, like I say, reshaping the geopolitical landscape of the world. And so he is definitely going to be in contention. I talked to one eminent Democratic historian from Yale, and I interviewed him for this book, and he actually said that Bush was one of three grand strategists, is the way he put it, in U.S. History when it comes to shaping our foreign policy, the other two being John Quincy Adams and Franklin Roosevelt. He said all three of these guys came up with profound changes in foreign policy in response to surprise attacks against America on our own soil. You had the burning of the White House in 1812, you had the Pearl Harbor, and you had 9/11. And so, you know, that's one way to look at it, too. He may be regarded as one of the really important presidents, even since the beginning of our history.
Bill Salmon is our guest, senior White House correspondent for The Washington Times. We're talking about the Bush presidency. He's author of a new book, Misunderestimated, The President Battles Terrorism, John Kerry, and the Bush Haters. Now, Bill's got it absolutely right there. History will tell. That is, history to come will tell us whether or not President George W. Bush, or any president for that matter, will emerge into the Hall of the Greats. However, with a massive terrorist attack on American soil, something unprecedented in human history or American history, with a war that followed both in Afghanistan and Iraq, we'll be talking about that in just a minute, there's certainly the opportunity to emerge into greatness. I'd like your thoughts on this as well as we talk with Bill Salmon, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We're also going to be talking about the preemptive nature of the war And Bill, he devotes an entire chapter to that. Do you remember this before the war? Dan Rather got a interview with Saddam Hussein prior to the Iraqi war. Do you remember that? He made the trip over there, finally ended up face to face with Saddam Hussein. I want to know from Bill Salmon why he devoted an entire chapter to that interview. If you'd like to join us, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And just a reminder before we continue our conversation, tonight at 8 o'clock from 8 to 9, we'll repeat the first hour of Issues, Etc., where we talk about the rise of evangelicalism with Dr. Mark Knoll of Wheaton College. That's from 8 to 9 on Issues, Etc. tonight. Bill, does the president consider the war with Iraq, jumping over Afghanistan if we could, does he consider that a preemptive war?
Yes, I think he does. I think that and he spelled it out in public a couple of months before the war, where he talked about this new policy of preemption, where we have to confront threats before they mature. Up until then, for the last I don't know how many decades, we'd had this policy of containment and deterrence, which worked very well during the Cold War against the Soviet Union, because we could contain them and we could deter them with for example, buildup of nuclear weapons. But you cannot contain terrorists when they are these sort of shadowy networks that are all in all of the countries of the world, including our own. And you certainly can't deter them by building up conventional military arms, because they don't have a state that you can attack. So he got rid of those policies and came up with this preemption where we would go out and take out the host states, potential host states like Iraq, where you have a rogue regime in power that could play host to a terrorist network, provide them with weapons of mass destruction, and cause us great harm. So, yeah, there's no question. Iraq was basically minding its own business in recent years, and we decided to liberate it.
And you devote an entire chapter to two chapters. One, early in the book, to Saddam Hussein's regime itself, what Saddam was like, his rise to power, where the guy came from. And also, I found this rather odd, I'd like you to explain it, the Dan Rather interview with Saddam Hussein prior to the war. Why did you devote an entire chapter to that interview?
Well, I devoted an entire chapter to that interview for a couple of reasons. One, I wanted to show what Saddam was thinking right before the war. And he had a lot of quotes to Dan Rather about, outrageous quotes about the United States, et cetera. And I wanted to give the reader a window into this guy's twisted mind. Secondly, I wanted to poke fun at Dan Rather, because here's a guy who, when he interviewed the elder President Bush when he was in the White House, berated him on national television by saying, "You made us fools in the face of the world because of Iran-Contra. How could you do that?" I mean, in this accusatory tone to the President of the United States. But then when he gets over there with the President of Iraq, a brutal tyrant and dictator, he is very deferential. "Mr. President, thank you so much for your time, please," and giving him these softball questions. And I thought that was worthy of pointing out to the reader, because I think the media is terribly biased in this country. And one of the things I talk about a lot in the book is what an abysmal job they do in covering things like the war on terror.
You have been accused, in fact, at the end of a chapter that you talk about going down to the ranch in Crawford, Texas, with the president and the first lady as part of the White House Corps. You mentioned that you were accused by Howard Kurtz of the Washington Post of, quote, going soft on the president after that event, where it was kind of a meet and greet type of a thing. How do you respond to that?
Well, it was amazing, because I was down at the ranch, and the president decided to give the press pool, which is a small group that represents the larger White House press corps, a tour of his ranch. And it was an extraordinary opportunity to have access to the President of the United States in an informal setting, not such an adversarial, in-your-face type of thing like a press conference, which we normally, encounter him in. So, one of the handlers, the president told us before the tour, he said, "Look, if you guys hit him with a lot of policy questions right out of the gate, he might cut the thing short." So I got together with the other reporters beforehand. I said, "Look, let's wait till we're way out in the woods, and then hit him with the tough questions, and we have to walk all the way back, and he'll answer them. So what happened was we took a three-hour walk on his ranch. Everything was fine. And on the way back, we said, look, Mr. President, would you mind answering some questions about policy? He said, absolutely not. Set up the camera. Let's do a press conference right here. And I hit him with questions about politics and terrorism and North Korea, and so did the other reporters. And everybody, he made lots of news. We put it in the front pages of all the newspapers the next day. It led all the newscasts that night. And then Howard Kurtz calls up, and because we didn't grill him for 3 hours while he took us around his own personal home and then inside his house for coffee with Mrs. Bush, Howard Kurtz suggested that I was going soft on the president. It's just extraordinary.
Your colleagues in the media are well aware of your critique of the media. How do they react to your criticism?
Well, it's actually kind of interesting because, I work, cheek to jowl with these White House correspondents from the other papers and the networks, et cetera. We travel, we're on the bus together, we're on the plane, we go to dinner. We spend a lot of time together, and I like just about every one of them. I mean, they're great company, they're funny, they're irreverent. They're sort of this esprit de corps, like we're all in it together type of a thing. And so individually, I have no problem with them. It's institutionally that I have a problem with the press because it has such an institutional bias and because, frankly, most of them are liberals. Just because people are liberals doesn't mean that, they're not friends of mine. But when they let that liberal bias seep into their coverage, then I feel like I'm entitled to point that out in an institutional sense.
Are you suggesting that there is a vast liberal media conspiracy?
No, but I will say this. The problem is not so much that it's a conspiracy, which suggests that they all get together and decide how they're going to sling it to the left on each day's story. The problem is that a lot of these people are they're liberals, and then they think that their worldview, their outlook on the world, is sort of the objective worldview, when it isn't. And so when they present the story, they think they're sort of reasonably presenting both sides because that strikes them as reasonable, but it doesn't strike the rest of America as reasonable. It seems biased to the rest of America. So I think a lot of the times the bias is subconscious. It's so deeply ingrained in the press corps. And there was a recent study by the Pew Foundation just a couple of weeks ago that showed that in the Washington press corps, five times more journalists describe themselves as liberal compared to those who describe themselves as conservative. Now, and that's with liberal being sort of a dirty word. I mean, if you use the word progressive, I think it would have been much higher. So it really is an imbalance in the press, and unfortunately it manifests itself in the daily coverage.
This White House is either acclaimed or notorious for being leak-proof, practically sealed up hermetically in terms of the leaks through staffers and aides and things like that. What's it like covering, as a reporter, covering a White House that is hermetically sealed?
Well, it can be frustrating as a daily newspaper reporter because they are quite tightly controlled, as you mentioned. It's interesting that you brought that up because I'm actually just finished writing a piece for tomorrow's Washington Times that talks about this and also talks about the fact that for the first time really in his first term, President Bush's first term, they're starting to loosen up a little bit as we get into the home stretch of the election here, or at least the last 4 or 5 months towards the election. President Bush has given 3 full press conferences this month. I mean, the first half of June, he gave 3 full press conferences. That's unheard of. Laura Bush gave every TV network an interview last week at the Group of Eight Economic Summit in Georgia and some bunch of newspapers. And so they're loosening up. They're getting Condi out there. They're getting Bush out there. They're getting Laura out there. And I think the reason is because, you got to make your case in an election year. Not only do you have to make your case about Iraq on a continuous basis, but you have to make your case politically about why George W. Bush deserves a second term. And so I think they realize that if they're not aggressive and not a little looser about, granting more access, that they're going to get hurt by John Kerry.
2 final questions with very little time here. First of all, Diane Sawyer did an interview with the president recently on television, and he mentioned there in the interview something that you also mentioned in your book, and that is he doesn't read the papers, maybe except the sports page. He gets it all distilled for him by aides. Is that an asset, or is that a disadvantage for this president?
I think it's an asset. He certainly regards it as an asset. He glances at the front pages of four daily newspapers, including my own. He doesn't watch a lot of the TV, the food fights on the cable shows. And what he does is, I mean, the guy's the president. He has staff that briefs him on the day's headlines first thing in the morning. Andrew Card, his chief of staff, briefs him. Scott McClellan, his press secretary, Dan Bartlett, his communications director, they keep him very well informed. And he actually keeps a pretty close sort of pulse on what the latest media obsession is. And he actually strategizes with his spokespeople to come up with the best way to respond to a story. I mean, he's aware of whether a story sort of has legs or whether it's not going to last very long. So he's a pretty savvy guy. He just doesn't wade through all of the negative coverage because he sort of knows what it's going to say.
Having written what amounts to really a character study of this president while he's still in the middle of his first term and going toward a possible reelection, what do you think November, the presidential elections, will be about now that you've gained some insight into this president?
I think it's going to be about leadership. I mean, you know, we talked about some of the issues that are starting to come off the table, the economy and some other issues. And so I think as issues fall away and as we get past the June 30th transfer of authority, and assuming things go well after that period in Iraq, at least relatively well, I think increasingly issues like likability will come to the fore. And issues like leadership and personal attributes, like, you know, who would you rather spend a Sunday afternoon with? You know, John Kerry or George W. Bush? People do polls on these kinds of things. And generally, on the personal assets, on the personal attributes, Bush comes out well ahead of Kerry. So I think that's what it's going to be about increasingly.
Bill Salmon, thank you very much for giving us your time. I'd like to have you back on, if we could, a little closer to the elections themselves. Thank you for being our guest.
Call anytime. Thanks for having me.
Bill Salmon is senior White House correspondent for the Washington Times. He's author of this new book called Misunderestimated: The President Battles Terrorism, John Kerry, and the Bush Haters. Tomorrow on the program, a couple things that I'd like you to keep in mind and tune in for. Is gay marriage neutral? Jennifer Roback Morse will be our guest to talk about that, of the Hoover Institute. We'll also be talking to Dr. Ben Witherington of Asbury Theological Seminary. What's the question there? The Gnostic Gospels. We'll be discussing that's kind of a perennial question with the whole Da Vinci Code still making the rounds. And then think about this question overnight. Be ready to talk about it during open lines. Rush Limbaugh was on his third wife. Now he's on his third divorce. He and his wife, Marta, of 10 years, I believe, thereabouts, are going to be divorced, if not already. It's made the press. Has he lost moral authority to speak on moral issues as a spokesman in radio? Has he lost it because of his divorce? We'll also be hearing from former Muslim Ergun Kaner on whether Christians and Muslims worship the same God. More audio from the meeting of the Southern Baptists there in Indianapolis. That's tomorrow on Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thank you for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.